6 months in about 3 weeks that we've been involved in the study of American history. And we as yet haven't even gotten to America. We're still dealing with the colonies. But our desire is for you to learn and to know what your heritage is and to know what the biblical and the scriptural basis is for your nation and the spiritual principles behind your nation's existence. They're not teaching in school, public schools, nor even in Christian schools anymore what your heritage is all about as a Christian. And as you lose your heritage, you lose your identity as an American, and certainly as a Christian American, you lose your identity, and our nation suffers because of it in this present time. So we're looking at American history, and so if you're in this class, you're going to learn American history this morning. If you'd prefer to learn something else, there are several other adult Sunday school classes you could participate in, but the doors are locked now, so you're stuck with me again this morning. We've come through the settlement of our country, as far as the colonies are concerned, and we're now up to a point in time right around 1774, just a few years before our country declared its independence on July the 4th, 1776. The problem has grown between England and the colonies, and it has not been eased in any way. As a matter of fact, it's become more antagonized as time has gone on. England, of course, and again, I guess the thing that I need to remind you of again and again and again is not to think of what's going on in the light of where we live. We can pick up a telephone, basically, and I call probably two or three countries every week. I talk to places around the world, missionaries and things of that nature. I pick up a telephone and dial Greece and talk to Brother Bailey over there in just a split second. We're not dealing with that ability here in 1774. If someone has some news for another person, it might take as long as 10 to 15 days to get that to the far outreaches of the colonies. You're not talking about a broadcast every night where you could turn on the television and see the events that have transpired in the last 24 or even 15 minutes, 24 hours or 15 minutes. But it takes a long period of time for that information to be spread through the colonies. And much longer even dealing with England. You're dealing with probably a 3 to 4 and even sometimes a 5 week voyage from England to the United States on a ship. And so if there's news that's coming from England to America or going the opposite direction from America to England, you're dealing with a 5 week delay in the processing of that information. You say, why is that important? Because you and I tend to think of everything in a split second. In other words, the battle was fought yesterday and today word reached, and it doesn't happen that way. When a battle is fought, sometimes it takes several weeks before that information even gets back to the other people that need to know that information so that another battle might be planned. So things move a lot slower in this time than they do in our own time. England is a monarchy that's in trouble. England has fought several wars with France, and we dealt with those wars that were fought. England, of course, is the greatest monarchy, the greatest government on the face of the earth up to the time our country declares independence. And England is having a problem holding on to all of its assets as far as its colonies are concerned. And particularly these colonies that are in America. And the reason being, these colonies in America were founded on some principles other than just conquering. This nation was not put together by a group of individuals that came and conquered a piece of ground. But there were some people that came and had some principles and some ideals and some objectives that they wanted to obtain. And because of that, an independent spirit has begun to pervade. Now, we talked about that independent spirit being developed by not only political individuals, but by religious individuals. When our country was established, it was established by two groups primarily, the Pilgrims and the Puritans. Two different groups entirely, two different complete viewpoints on the way things should be done. Of course, the Pilgrims were people. They were separatists. They believed that there were no ties between the Anglican Church and themselves. They had made complete break. They didn't ask any favors from the Anglican Church, nor did they grant any to the Anglican Church. The second group were the Puritans. The Puritans were those individuals that sought to purify the Anglican system. Both of those people were saved. Both of those people, genuinely converted people, they believed in being saved just as clearly as you and I do. You read their testimonies. Matter of fact, I've read some of their testimonies that are better than most of the preacher's testimonies I've ever read. These people love the Lord. And you say, well, there were some lost people in that group. I know some lost Baptists, too. But these people, as far as a group, genuinely loved the Lord. They had different political ideals. They had different ecclesiastical ideals. And the Puritans sought to purify the Anglican Church. Their desire was to change the system that was wrong. Anglicanism was just an offshoot of Catholicism. It was kind of an English Catholic system. They had taken the structure of the Roman Catholic Church in England when Henry VIII had broken ties and had developed that into an English system, which more or less was a Protestant system, but was more like what you and I would call ultra-liberals in this day and time today. Puritans wanted to reform that. Both groups came to America. The Pilgrims settled, first of all, of course, in Plymouth, and then the rest of Massachusetts colony settled by the Puritans, and all of that became the Plymouth colony. Because of their distance from England, even the Puritans found over a period of time that they had to remain independent from the Anglican Church. The ties on which they parted from the Anglican Church were not good. And even the Puritans were the object of persecution under the crown. And so they had to dissolve their connections, or most of them, with the Anglican Church. They became more and more independent because of the problems with England and the Anglican Church. Also because of the influence of the Pilgrims, which were right there with them. But because of those two influences, even the Puritans began to dissolve their ties to the Anglican ecclesiastical system. They became independent churches. They became what we would term basically autonomous. Anybody know what that word means? If you're a Baptist, you don't know what that means. Autonomous means they ruled themselves. They governed themselves. And that's what the basis under an independent church is all about. This is all of Hope Baptist Church that there is. When we want to make a decision, we don't pick up the phone and call some headquarters somewhere and say, can we do this? We don't have to ask for some group of fellows that live, you know, 400 or 500 miles away to tell us whether we can or cannot. We make our decisions here, and if we make a mistake, we answer for our own mistakes here. We want to buy a piece of property, we raise the money. We want to pay for it, we raise the money. It comes from here. That's an independent, autonomous, functioning church. They govern themselves. You see, autonomy has never been a doctrinal issue. Autonomy is a governmental issue. And churches became autonomous. England seized their colonies with these churches growing more and more autonomous, more and more independent, and also the independent political ideals that are being spread through the colonies. And England sees a problem in hanging on to their colonies. Now, England's belief with colonies was called mercantilism. Hopefully you remember what that means. That means that a colony exists solely for the benefit of the mother country. It's the only reason it exists. You say, that's terrible. No, it's great. That's exactly the thought that made this country great as far as the work ethic is concerned. When you go to work, you belong to your boss. And the only reason he hires you is not because he cares about your welfare. It's because he wants to make money. Our country today is eat up with this philosophy of, I have a right to make all this money, my boss owes it to me. Your boss doesn't owe you anything. And today you hear people that own businesses derided as, you know, money grubbers. And yeah, that's basically right. That's the reason you have a job. If that fellow hadn't have been a money grubber, he might have been content just to hire two people and not ever see his company grow. But because he wanted more money, he built a bigger company with bigger buildings and bigger factories and bigger output and needed more people. So you got a job in the whole. And then we turn around and say, well, I have my rights as a worker. And that's why America is in such bad shape economically. You've got a right to go to work and say yes, sir, and no, sir, and do the work. Take your paycheck and go home. I just thought I'd throw that in this morning. You say, what is it? That's an independent attitude. I'm thoroughly red, white, and blue all the way through. Independent, autonomous, workplace, government, religion. I mean, just it's independent. And you'll suffer whenever you get away from that. So England is trying to figure out a way to hang on to these, really this buried treasure that's here in America. How can we keep control over this thing while independence is growing in America? They begin to do so legislatively. I said to you last week, whenever any government seeks to maintain its authority by legislation, it becomes tyranny. If a government cannot maintain its authority through the mindset of its own people, it's in trouble. There must be the consent of the governed. You'll hear that term over and over again in the writings of Washington, Jefferson, Adams. The consent of the governed. In other words, we consent to this leadership. When that leadership loses that consent, that nation either dies or they turn around and by legislative means try to secure control over their people. Whenever they do that, it becomes tyranny. It's a doomed system. It will never recover. There's not an instance in the history of the world where a system ever recovered from that situation. It's a doomed system. But England begins by legislative means to try and control its colonies. It did so, first of all, with what we looked at called the Navigation Acts. The Navigation Acts merely prohibited the colonies from trading with one another. You were not allowed to trade your corn crop for their whatever they produced. You could not trade intercolony. The goods had to leave this country and go to England and then be shipped back to the other colonies. Why? So England could make her cut. England wanted a cut of the profits. You have the Navigation Act. You have the Woolens Act. You have the Hat Act, which stated that the colonists couldn't even manufacture hats because they would hurt the English hat trade. So what they had to do was they could buy, make all the materials here and ship them to England. The hats were produced there and sent back to America and purchased by the colonists. The Woolens Act stated that you could grow sheep and harvest the wool, but you couldn't manufacture that wool into anything. It had to go to England to be processed. And so you see how England, by legislative means, sought to control its colonies, forbidding them to trade with one another. Now, the colonists and began to develop a principle. That principle is found in the Word of God. I'm asked all the time, how do you determine what your allegiance to the government is? And that's not my issue here. Not to determine whether you are obligated to owe allegiance. I would suggest you pay taxes. I would suggest you do what the government says. But the battle is not mine to fight. But the Pilgrims and the Puritans that made up the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they used the Word of God. Take your Bible and come to 2 Samuel for a minute. They used a biblical principle for determining when they owed allegiance to a government and when they didn't. And this has long since been a basis of religious dissent down through the history of our country. It's based on a biblical principle. I realize Romans 13 in the New Testament tells us we are obligated to a government. I understand that. And I believe that. I believe the government exists for the good of the people under the realm of God. That's the way God set it up. And people say, well, you know, you're obligated because of the Bible. The Bible portrays what relationship you are to have with government, and you're not allowed to break that relationship. And again, don't get me wrong, I'm not arguing that. But the colonists believe this. If the Word of God spells out the responsibility that I have as a citizen to the government, and I am obligated because the Bible tells me, as a citizen of the government, I am obligated. Doesn't the Bible have a right to tell the government what its obligation is to the citizen? And that was their whole basis. And that basis was built on 2 Samuel chapter 23, verse 3. The God of Israel said, "The Rock of Israel spake to me, He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." Now, whose idea is that? Whose opinion is that? That's God's opinion. God's definition of government, then, is here. He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. That sounds almost like some modern-day group, you know, that's ready to take over. That's what the Pilgrims' attitude was. And their attitude was this: England, we owe allegiance to the crown, but not to the Parliament, not to the Prime Minister. All of the English colonies owe allegiance to the crown of England. We all are English citizens and we all owe allegiance to the crown. However, the Parliament was established to rule Great Britain, the island, the state of Great Britain. And it has no right to rule colonies halfway around the world who are not represented in that body. And we pointed out to you the fact that the colonists maintained they were not being represented in government. However, the British Crown maintained that they were represented in government. The British Crown maintained that the Parliament represented all of the peoples of the English realm, and therefore you are being represented. We remember the term taxation without representation. The Crown never accepted that. They said, you are being represented. You are. Your legislators are here in the British Parliament. But the colonists did not accept that. They appealed to 2 Samuel 23:3. They said, wait a minute, we want justice. We want justice, and we're not getting justice. And so the problem began to grow. England tries to gain that control with the legislative acts. As those acts don't work, and I mentioned to you the fact that those acts did little more in the colonies than breed a system of smuggling and boycott. That's basically the way the colonists responded. Smuggling and boycott. In other words, we can't get any goods here without paying a high price from England, so we'll smuggle them across the colonial border here from Virginia up into Massachusetts or wherever we have to go. We'll get what we need. And smuggling was a way of life here. Not only that, but there was boycott. And ships would sail from England loaded down with goods for the colonies, and when they would arrive, the colonists would turn them around and send them back. You can imagine what a trader in London would think, having loaded a ship, secured that ship, rented that ship, paid for that ship, put all of the goods into the hold of that ship, realizing that on a normal Atlantic voyage, he would sometimes lose half of the goods that he placed in the hold of that ship. Because of water damage, rats, rodents, those type of things, he would lose half of what he was sending, only to have it come to America and then turned around and sent back, where he would lose half of what he had sent. And so the tide, the sentiment in England began to be anger toward the colonies because of their rebellion, because of their stubbornness, because of their refusal to just go along with the system the way it was. And more legislative acts were passed. We talked about the Iron Act, which said that the colonists could mine iron ore, but they could not produce anything without iron ore. It had to go to England to be refined. All of those acts culminated about 1774 in some acts which were called the Coercive Acts by the English. In America, the colonists called them the Intolerable Acts. And these acts, these legislative enactments, were the basis behind which the colonists finally said, enough is enough. And the last one that we talked about last week, you've never read about in a history book. But it is the one act that provoked the colonists to begin their move for independence. It was called the Quebec Act. Maybe you remember that last week. Okay. How many of you ever read that in high school yearbook somewhere? Studied that? Never studied the Quebec Act. Reckon why? If you took American history, they never taught you about the Quebec Act. Let me ask you a question this morning. What's the one thing you can do to a Protestant who just came out of Reformation England, what's the one thing a Protestant fears more than anything else at this period of time? I'll tell you what it is, it's the papacy. Remember when Columbus discovered America, Martin Luther was 10 years of age. During these couple of hundred years that the colonies have formed, the Reformation has taken place in England. We talked about the fact that at Salem in the Massachusetts colony, less than a dozen people were burned for witchcraft or executed for witchcraft. And you read about it in every history book you pick up. But at the same time, close to 1 million people in northern Italy were executed for witchcraft by the Roman Catholic Church, and you never heard a word about it. You don't read about it. It's not mentioned in history textbooks. The same period of time, 1 million people, they were called Albigensians and Waldensians and Huguenots. They were Protestants. One of the greatest bloodsheds that ever occurred was what was called the Counter-Reformation. It makes Adolf Hitler's execution of the Jews look like a Sunday school picnic. I mentioned to you, I've been in several of the cities in Europe, Rotenburg in Germany, where every Protestant man, woman, boy, and girl were executed by the papal armies as they came through in an attempt to undo the Reformation. We talked last week about Zwingli in Switzerland, and Zwingli, how he defended against the papal armies, the people of Switzerland, and Switzerland is the only country today in Europe that has a Protestant origin to it, or Protestant heritage. All the rest of them are Roman Catholic. You say, are you being anti-Catholic? No, I'm not anti-Catholic. I'm anti-papist. The papacy has never done anything good for this world other than cause bloodshed. That's all they have ever done. And you say, well, you hate Roman Catholics. Well, that's untrue. Half of this church are converted Roman Catholics. Matter of fact, better than half. Probably 3/4 of them. You say, well, you just... No, I hate the system. The papal system is a system of tyranny. And that's easily provable anywhere you go in the world. You go to Northern Ireland today. Who has the real ability to cause those people in Northern Ireland to lay down their guns? Who goes all over the world preaching peace? Why don't you get them to put down their guns and quit fighting? Just a thought. Just wanted you to think about that. Now, the worst thing you can do to a Protestant at this time, the Spanish Inquisition does not cease until 1858. The Inquisition was the means by which the Catholic Church sought to bring Protestants back into the fold under means of torture. I've been to the Crime and Punishment Museum in Rotenburg where many of those devices were developed to persecute Protestants. I've seen what they call the mouth pair, which was a small device that was inserted into an individual's mouth who had spoken out against the church. And a crank was turned, and as that crank turned, it opened in the mouth until it dislocated the jaw from the skull. And then a pair of scissors were taken. I've seen them. And those scissors, a pair of pliers pulled the tongue, and the scissors cut the tongue off while the mouth pair was... I've seen that stuff. You say, what was that used for? That was used to bring people back into the good graces of the church. I'm going to ask you a question. If you were a Protestant, the one thing you'd fear more than anything else is the papal system. And under the Quebec Act, realizing this, England is a Protestant nation. And England had defeated France in 1757 at the end of the French and Indian War. The Treaty of Paris had been signed, and as concession, Great Britain had basically won all of the French holdings, including Quebec, Toronto, up in Canada. And under the Quebec Act, the English crown totally reversed itself. You see that a lot in America in these days, the government in Washington, but very unusual in those days. The English crown totally reversed itself by doing three things. Three of them. Number one, the English crown disassembled the Anglican church in all of Quebec province. I mentioned to you, this is not religious liberty. What the Anglican Crown said is that no Protestant church has a right to exist in the Quebec province anymore. And that the Roman Catholic Church is accepted as the sole church in the Quebec province. That was the British Crown, a Protestant church. Protestant Crown that said that. Number two, they extended the boundaries of Quebec province. Quebec, of course, is up in Canada, north of the St. Lawrence Seaway there, north of the Great Lakes. And they said, well, we're going to make the boundaries a little different. From this date, the southern boundary of Quebec province is the Ohio River. And the western boundary is the Mississippi River. Now, think about it for a moment. What did that do to the Massachusetts colony? It basically cut it off from any westward expansion, and it put the Roman Catholic papal system to the west, and it put the English system to the east across the ocean. They were virtually surrounded. These were those independent spirits. Listen, these are your forerunners today. Independent sort of people. And now they're surrounded. And then thirdly, what the crown did, excuse me, I'm going to get them all straight. Okay. Thirdly, what they did is they established, my notes are laying sideways in case you're wondering what I was doing. Thirdly, they established a new system of government. You see, the colonies of England basically had a right to self-participation or participation in their government. The colonies had that right. The colonies had constructed or put together some simplified form of local rule. They had a house of burgesses or a house of commons. And they were allowed to enact certain laws to govern themselves. They were not completely self-governing. They were not autonomous because the crown was always over their head. But they were given a limited amount of their own rule. Under the Quebec Act, the crown said, colonies no longer have that right to do that, but we will place, and they put their own structure of government there, which basically was just shy of a monarchy. Under the British crown, they set up a totalitarian rule. So now you've got a system on the western corner of the most independent of the colonies, which is ruled and governed by a tyrant under the British realm. Roman Catholicism is the mainstay of that country, and it is illegal to build a Protestant church in that country or in that province. I read to you last week the words of Thomas Jefferson in response to the Quebec Act and how he was appalled that Britain would so affront the colonies as to, in a sense, in your face, put this colony together. Those words that I quoted to you were from the Declaration of Independence of the United States of America. Those words in the Declaration of Independence were a complete word-for-word response to the Quebec Act. And the Quebec Act's never even been taught in American schools. It was important enough for a paragraph in the Declaration of Independence to deal with it. But it was not important enough for the public school system or the Christian school system to deal with it. Somebody doesn't want you to know your heritage. Somebody wants to hide your heritage from you and conceal it from you. Based upon that, plus the fact that the British had suffered a great humiliation at the loss of a little bit of tea in Boston Harbor. You see, most of those acts had been eased a bit. And by the way, that's the way aggressors work, is they jump 5 feet and then back up 2 feet. You think you've got a break, but they've actually secured 3 feet of control. And the British jumped way over here and then they backed up and said, okay, colonists, we'll ease those tariffs on all these goods. We'll drop that tariff a little bit on everything except tea. And we still want you to pay this tax on tea because we want you to know the crown is still in control and the parliament still has the right to make the laws. 2 years later, when the East India Tea Company nearly went bankrupt, which was a company that belonged to the British Crown, they said, everybody has to pay the tariffs except the East India Tea Company. At that point, when a ship laden with tea sailed into Boston Harbor, a bunch of patriots dressed up like Indians went out to the ship. You know the story. It's a famous story. Dumped all the tea overboard. The Boston Tea Party. You remember what happened as a result of the Boston Tea Party? The Crown and again enacted legislation. They said, we're going to blockade the port at Boston until all of the tea is paid for. Until that governmental system relinquishes its control back to the Crown, and those people come back under the umbrella. I mean, after all, we're all here for the same reason. We always want to see the good of mankind, the most noble words. And they blockaded the port at Boston. The fatal mistake that the British made was to blockade the port at Boston because it unified a bunch of independent colonies. You see, those colonies never wanted to be united. And when we get to the Civil War, you're going to find out what a great injustice was done in the Civil War. Those colonies never wanted to exist as a united nation. They wanted to exist as their own independent sovereign entities. They wanted to function together, certainly. They wanted to trade together, certainly. But they wanted the strong governmental source to be the government of those individual colonies or states, as the case may be. It's called states' rights. And that was the premise under which part of the Brady Bill this last week or week and a half ago was found unconstitutional. There still is a little element of that in your Constitution that even the Supreme Court had to acknowledge. The states' rights. Power was vested in the states unless it was specifically granted to the federal government in the Constitution. But prior to that, these colonies wanted to maintain their own independence. Massachusetts didn't want to be linked up with Virginia. Virginia didn't want to be linked up with Georgia. Georgia didn't want to be linked up with Rhode Island, and Rhode Island could care less about Connecticut. They wanted to trade. They wanted to function. They wanted to worship God. They didn't care about being some great, big, strong nation. But what happened when the British blockaded the port at Boston is these other colonies came to the rescue. You see, the only mainstay of life was that port. Alive by bringing provisions from England that they could not get here. And those people faced starvation very quickly, but the other colonies came to the rescue, and all at once that strong linking of power became obvious to these people as the way that they were going to have to go. Quebec Act passed in 1774. As a result also of the Quebec Act, the First Continental Congress assembled themselves. The First Continental Congress assembled themselves, and the delegate from Massachusetts, which had been blockaded by the British, came to represent his colony. Among those other colonies, his name was John Adams. He was to become the President of the United States later on in life. He represented his colony. The House of Burgesses, March the 28th, 1775. Let me give you an idea of what's going on. Let me read to you a speech. This was delivered to the House of Burgesses in 1775. He said, "Preacher, I have no idea what this has to do with the Bible. This has to do with the fact that you're going to lose your Bible in the next 3 years in this country because you don't have any idea what your heritage is." You say, "Well, I just don't believe that." Wait till your guns are gone and see what you believe. "Mr. President," this is given to the House of Burgesses, March 28, 1775. This is less than a year before, as a matter of fact, it's less than a month before Concord and Lexington. "Mr. President, no man thinks more highly than I do of the patriotism as well as the abilities of the very worthy gentlemen who have just addressed the House. But different men often see the same subject in different lights. And therefore, I hope that it will not be thought disrespectful to those gentlemen if, entertaining as I do opinions of a character very opposite to theirs, I shall speak forth my sentiments freely and without reserve. This is no time for ceremony. The question before the House is one of awful moment to this country. For my own part, I consider it nothing less than a question of freedom or slavery, and in proportion to the magnitude of the subject ought to be the freedom of the debate. It is only in this way that we can hope to arrive at truth and fulfill the great responsibility which we hold to God and our country. Should I keep back my opinions at such a time through fear of giving offense? I should consider myself as guilty of treason towards my country and an act of disloyalty towards the majesty of heaven, which I revere above all earthly kings. Mr. President, it is natural to man to indulge in the illusions of hope. We are apt to shut our eyes against the painful truth and listen to the song of that siren till she transforms us into beasts. Is this the part of wise men engaged in a great and arduous struggle for liberty? Are we disposed to be of the number of those who, having eyes, see not, and having ears, hear not the things which so nearly concern their temporal salvation? For my part, whatever anguish of spirit it may cost, I am willing to know the whole truth, to know the worst, and to provide for it. But I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. I know no way of judging the future but by the past. And judging by the past, I wish to know what there has been in the conduct of the British ministry for the last 10 years to justify those hopes with which the gentlemen have been pleased to solace themselves and the House. It is that insidious smile with which our petition has been lately received. Trust it not, sir. It will prove a snare to your feet. Suffer not yourselves to be betrayed with a kiss. Yes, always hear these. You can almost tell what he's been reading. Ask yourselves how this gracious reception of our petition comports with these warlike preparations which cover our waters and darken our land. Are fleets and armies necessary to a work of love and reconciliation? Have we shown ourselves so unwilling to be reconciled that force must be called in to win back our love? Let us not deceive ourselves, sir. These are the implements of war and subjugation, the last arguments to which kings resort. I ask, gentlemen, sir, what means this martial array, if its purpose be not to force us to submission? Can gentlemen assign any other possible motives for it? Has Great Britain any enemy in this quarter of the world to call for this accumulation of navies and armies? No, sir, she has none. They are meant for us. They can be meant for no other. They are sent over to bind and rivet upon those chains which the British ministry have so long been forging. And what have we to oppose them? Shall we try argument? Sir, we have been trying that for the last 10 years. Have we anything new to offer on the subject? Nothing. We have held the subject up in every light it is capable, but it has been all in vain. Shall we resort to entreaty and humble supplication? What terms shall we find which have not been already exhausted? Let us not, I beseech you, sir, deceive ourselves any longer. Sir, we have done everything that could be done to avert the storm which is now coming on. We have petitioned, we have remonstrated, we have supplicated, we have prostrated ourselves before the throne and have implored its interposition to arrest the tyrannical hands of the ministry and parliament. Our petitions have been slighted. Our remonstrances have been produced additional violence, and insult. Our supplications have been disregarded, and we have been spurned with contempt from the foot of the throne. In vain, after these things, may we indulge the fond hope of peace and reconciliation. There is no longer any room for hope. If we wish to be free, if we mean to preserve inviolate those inestimable privileges for which we have so long been contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have been so long engaged and which we have pledged ourselves never to abandon until the glorious object of our contest shall be attained, we must fight. I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left us. They tell us, sir, that we are weak, unable to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be the next week or the next year? Will it be when we are totally disarmed and when a British guard shall be stationed in every house? Shall we gather strength by irresolution and inaction? Shall we acquire the means of effectual resistance by lying supinely on our backs and hugging the delusive phantom of hope until our enemies have bound us hand and foot? Sir, we are not weak if we make proper use of the means which the God of nature hath placed in our power. 3 millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a country as that which we possess are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations and who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Besides, sir, we have no election. If we were base enough to desire it, it is now too late to retire from the contest. There is no retreat but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable, and let it come. I repeat, sir, let it come. It is vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the chains of price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. When's the last time you heard a politician make a speech like that? That was Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry was not a high school graduate. Patrick Henry made himself into an attorney and then a representative of the colonies. Patrick Henry was a convert of George Whitefield during the Great Awakening. He was a Bible-believing Christian. And that's the attitude of the colonies in 1775. That was in March, in April of 1775. You see, the port of Boston has been blockaded. 4,000 regular British troops have been sent into Boston alone under the command of General Gage. And there they have stationed themselves. The colonists have begun by just basically making them as uncomfortable as they possibly can. First of all, they refused to build barracks. They could not find any carpenters that were willing to build barracks for the British troops. Nobody wanted the money that badly. Then when they finally imported from Nova Scotia some builders, they couldn't purchase any wood. Just obstinate at every point is what you find the colonists being. And within 20 miles of where they are encamped in Boston, the Patriots have formed themselves into a little group called Minutemen. Minutemen because they were not professional soldiers. They were individuals that farmed, that ran shops, that ran livery stables, that conducted their affairs every day normally as you and I would, but on the stroke of a minute they could assemble themselves fully armed and ready to fight. Hence the name Minutemen. These Minutemen have been drilling and training near Lexington and Concord. Concord, 20 miles from Boston. The handwriting is on the wall. It is ominous, but it is there nonetheless. These people now have a desire for freedom and liberty. And again, let me say, not to break from England and honor to the crown. You're going to find, as a matter of fact, until 1776, the 4th of July, no one contemplated such a complete removal from the scope of the British realm. What these colonists want is they want to whip England so badly that the Parliament will leave them alone and let them govern themselves. Still owing allegiance to the British crown, but nonetheless able to make their own laws. Those 4,000 troops gathered under General Thomas Gage, and the Minutemen training all around them. Gage formulates a plan, and his idea is this. What Henry has said is true. There will never be a moment when the time for battle is better than right now. Patrick Henry, for his reasons, thought it best to fight now. Gage, for his reasons, thought it best to fight right now. Gage formulates a plan by which he will take 700 of his armed British regulars to the little town of Concord, where the Minutemen have been storing ammunition and powder. But what is it? It's a disarming move that starts the Revolutionary War. Gage plans on taking those 700 men and disarming the Patriots. He decides that in the process, he'll take those troops through Lexington, and while they're in Lexington, he will arrest Sam Adams and John Hancock, who are the leaders. Remember Hancock? He's the one that signs the Declaration of Independence so big because he didn't want the king to miss who he was. They're going to arrest those two individuals who are the ringleader. And on the morning of April the 18th, they prepare to march towards Lexington and Concord and set out at a fast pace. And this is where you've all heard of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. This is where that midnight ride of Paul Revere is to take place, for the Patriots had their own spy system set up there in Boston. And the system was set up so that in the event of a British march or an invasion of the Americans or the Minutemen, a signal would be given in the north tower of the old church there in Boston. And when that signal was received, it was to send out all of those messengers. Remember, you couldn't turn on television. You couldn't pick up a radio broadcast. You couldn't even get a telegraph. Somebody had to ride on horseback to inform those individuals of what was going on. And you remember it was one if by land and two if by sea. They wanted to know how the British were coming. And of course, when Gage sets off on his march by land, the lantern is hung and Revere rides in one direction and a couple of his other cohorts ride in other directions. Paul Revere is 41 years of age. The other men that rode with him were 31 and 21. And they rode off to warn the Patriots of what was coming. So when the British regulars arrive the next morning around 10 o'clock at the little city of Lexington. Adams and Hancock have long since been taken out to safety, but there facing the British troops as they come in are the little handful of Minutemen. History gets a little obscure at this point, depending on who you read. Some say that the Patriots decided to disassemble themselves because of the mass of the British troops and to place themselves in battle at another point and another time. Some say that they stood their ground. Whether they did or didn't, I guess we probably will never know for certain because there are disagreeing opinions. But for some reason, shots were fired. There's been a disagreement over who fired the first shots. Interestingly enough, Britain says the colonists did and the colonists said Britain did. But both sides, strangely enough, will agree that the first shots that were heard were those of pistol volleys. And only the British officers carried pistols. So we must assume that if they are all in agreement that the first shots that were fired were pistol shots, and only the British officers carried pistols, we must deduce that the first shots were fired by the British. But several of the Americans are dropped there in the battle. April the 19th, 1775. And by the time the thing is over with, they proceed from there. And everything goes haywire and havoc. I mean, we need to get the picture in our mind. Have any of you ever seen an old black powder rifle go off? Brother Rex has, from inside a van. An old black powder rifle was an interesting weapon. It could fire, I guess, even greater than a 50 caliber shell, which is probably as big around as that thing right there, which is a pretty good hunk of lead coming at you. But it used black powder. And black powder, if you've ever seen anybody fire a black powder gun, basically surrounds the guy who pulls the trigger in a cloud of white smoke for some minutes because it is just very smoky. And you can imagine 700 British soldiers and 300 or so colonists firing those guns and what the commons must have looked like there at Lexington before they were done. You couldn't see anything. So everything fell into havoc. And Gage reassembled his troops to march towards Concord in order to capture the ammunition. And, of course, you know the story. By the time he got to Concord, they had moved most of the ammunition out of the place where he captured a little of it, but he didn't capture nearly what he wanted to capture. And then he began to return. And as he returned, the colonists had used or developed the tactics that they had learned in the French and Indian War. Remember, the British were professional soldiers. To them, you lined up in a row with another row behind that and another row behind that. The first row knelt and fired while the second row stood and fired. When those two had fired, they withdrew to reload their weapons and the next row came forward and knelt and fired. So you had almost a continual volley of fire. They lined up in a great big line and fought that way. But the colonists had learned in the French and Indian War that there was another tactic to fighting called today guerrilla warfare. They didn't know what guerrillas were, but that's the way they fought. They hid in the bushes. And as Gage began to return with his army, the Minutemen hid themselves along the road, and it was almost a continual ambush from Concord all the way back to where they eventually ended up near Boston. At the end of the day, 93 of the Patriots were dead, and 273 British Redcoats were gone. Now you say, well, that's not real decisive numbers, but you've got to imagine what that did for the colonists. The colonists who had basically convinced themselves that they could not win a war against the British crown had overwhelmed the British, and 273 British soldiers were out of action. Captain John Parker had commanded that group that had assembled there at Lexington. He had seen the first men fall. Those were called the shots heard round the world. It came as the first defeat for the British in what was later to be known as the Revolutionary War. Ethan Allen immediately took some of his fellows. I know you all looked at me funny. He made furniture, right? Yeah, he did more than make furniture, though. Ethan Allen assembled a group of men called the Green Mountain Boys. Sound like a bunch of hillbillies? They were. And the Green Mountain Boys, they were experts in guerrilla warfare. And off went Ethan Allen with his fellows, and they went up to upstate New York there upon one of the Great Lakes, and they were going to attack Fort Ticonderoga. Ethan Allen was a Bible-believing Christian. And you find accounts of his prayers for his men and for the battle as they go. And as they neared Fort Ticonderoga, he met up with another fella, a despicable sort of fella. He was a colonel. His name was Benedict Arnold. And Benedict Arnold said, they sent me to take charge of this operation. And Ethan Allen said, nope, I'm in charge here. And after some haggling back and forth, they decided, well, we'll go together. And the next morning, when they neared Fort Ticonderoga, some unusual things had happened. For instance, someone had left the gate open. There's no reason to have a fort, folks, if you leave the gate open. But for some reason, early in the morning hours, the gate was wide open. And, of course, Benedict Arnold attributed it to the British clumsiness, and Ethan Allen attributed it to answered prayers. And in they rushed, Arnold and Ethan Allen side by side, I guess trying to figure out which one could get ahead of the other one as they marched in through that gate. And as they went through the gate, a sentry, the only sentry on duty, drew up his weapon and aimed and pulled the trigger, and it didn't go off. Again, Arnold attributed it to bad powder. Ethan Allen attributed it to answered prayer. And in just a few moments, the entire British regiment that was there had surrendered to the forces of Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys. Several days later, they took another fort at Crown Point. And you say, what's going on? The colonists are making some real stride here. The Second Continental Congress convenes. And in May, and when they did, they appoint a commander-in-chief of their armies, a man who had suffered humiliating defeats in the French and Indian War. And his name was George Washington. George Washington is placed as commander-in-chief of the colonists or the colonial militia. By the end of May of 1775, remember, April was the start of all this. By the end of May, the British forces, Gage, has been joined by three other divisions of British regulars. General Howe, General Clinton, and General Burgoyne have joined up and linked forces with him. Brought an additional 1,500 men. But the only problem is they're surrounded in Boston. The Minutemen have formed all around them, and they're basically stuck. You see, everybody thought this was going to be a real short war. It didn't quite end up being a real short war. But God has been on the side of the colonists to this point. God has protected them. And now they have surrounded the fort there. Let me read to you a little bit about Washington. I know there's a lot of statements, and I am not, don't get me wrong, I'm not like many that try to make a Christian out of every American patriot. One of the greatest books I've read, and if you haven't read it, it'd be worth your reading it. It's called The Light and the Glory by a man by the name of Peter Marshall. Peter Marshall has a couple of fatal flaws in what he writes. First of all, he ignores completely the papacy. And number two, he tries to Christianize. He makes Christopher Columbus a Christian because of one writing that he put down in his diary, which is basically absurd. It's wrong to try and make a Christian out of somebody that obviously wasn't. I don't believe Thomas Jefferson was a Christian. Thomas Jefferson was a deist, and he's probably in hell today. But he's one of the most noble men that ever lived on the face of this earth, without a doubt. He's far more noble than most fundamental Baptist preachers I know today. A greater man of morality and a greater man of principle. But you got to make sure you don't make the mistake of trying to make a guy a Christian. You see, Christianity has sunk to such a low ebb in this day and time that because these people were such high caliber, the only thing we can do is make them Christians. Because if we don't, it indicts us for the lives that we live. Christopher Columbus was a lost Roman Catholic. All right, and he sailed under a Catholic flag. And he was not a saved man. But this is an excerpt from The Light and the Glory. Again, I think it's well worth your reading. Probably the best history book you'll read. A book found in Yale Divinity School Library was written by a man by the name of William Johnson, and it was entitled George Washington the Christian. It had been out of print for over half a century. And in that were some excerpts that George Washington had written with his own hand. And again, I'm not trying to make a Christian out of George Washington, but I'll let you read what he read. I know before Washington went into battle, he was baptized by a Baptist preacher. And if a Baptist preacher is anything like Baptist preachers are today, you don't get baptized for just any reason. So I'm not against trying to stretch the point. One of the entries in his diary that he wrote is called his Daily Sacrifice. Quote, "Let my heart, therefore, gracious God, be so affected with the glory and majesty of Thine honor that I may not do mine own works, but wait on Thee and discharge those weighty duties which Thou requirest of me." Another entry reads this, "O most glorious God, I acknowledge and confess my faults and the weak and imperfect performance of the duties of this day. I have called on Thee for pardon and forgiveness of sins, but so coldly and carelessly that my prayers are become my sin and stand in need of pardon. I have heard Thy holy word with such deadness of spirit that I have been an unprofitable and forgetful hearer. But O God, who art rich in mercy and plenteous in redemption, mark not, I beseech Thee, what I have done amiss. Remember that I am but dust, and remit my transgressions, negligences, and ignorances, and cover them with all Thy absolute obedience of, with all the absolute obedience of Thy dear Son, that those sacrifices of which I have offered may be accepted by Thee, and for the sacrifice of Jesus Christ offered upon the cross for me." Another one reads this, "Direct my thoughts, words, and work, wash away my sins in the immaculate blood of the Lamb, and purge my heart by Thy Holy Spirit. Daily frame me more and more into the likeness of Thy Son, Jesus Christ." And then finally, another one says, "Thou gavest Thy Son to die for me, and hast given me assurance of salvation upon my repentance and sincerely endeavoring to conform my life to His holy precepts and example." That's George Washington wrote that. I don't know if it makes him a Christian or not. I know a lot of Christians don't write stuff like that, but it's not mine to judge whether he was or whether he wasn't saved with so clear a testimony given to the fact that he well could have been. But I know this, he took command of the troops, and Gage now, who is surrounded, begins to feel the pinch. When you humiliate a British general and train British soldiers using nothing more than a handful of farmers, it's time to do something. And Gage decides it's time to show these colonists what the British Army is all about. He decides to amass a frontal assault at Bunker Hill. But to give you an idea how smart he was actually fought at Breed's Hill. He thought it was Bunker Hill. And it's always been known as the battle at Bunker Hill. But it was never fought at Bunker Hill. It was fought at Breed's Hill. He amasses his troops and he begins to ascend the heights. The colonists have dug in. They're ready. You see, the second fault that the British had was to try and assault a bunch of troops that were dug in, fortified. They began to march the hill. Again, the steady lines following one after another up the hill with the bagpipes and the drums and the brilliant red coats. And I mean, really a rather ominous looking sight, unless you're looking down a barrel of a gun. And up the hill they come. And there was no response from the trenches and the fortifications. And on they came. You see, the commander had issued the famous command, "Don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes." See, isn't it amazing how many of these things you've heard all your life and didn't know where they came from? The Battle of Bunker Hill, Breed's Hill. Up they came until they neared with almost within 30 yards of where the fortifications were, and then they let go such a volley that killed nearly half of the British immediately and routed the rest of them. Down the hill they went. And so Gage, not to be outdone, assembled all of his men very quickly, got them in line again, and marched right back up the hill. This time they waited until they got even closer and opened up and just nailed the British. And down the hill they ran again. Gage organized his men again and started up the hill. Only this time he had amassed behind his front lines a bayonet assault. Gage did not know it, but the colonists were basically out of ammunition. That's all they had. But still they stood and held their trenches, and Gage came up the hill. And as soon as they got within 4 or 5 feet of the trenches, they opened up again and dropped another great number of them. But now they were out of ammunition. And the British leaped into the trenches and leaped into the fortifications and began to rout the colonists. And the colonists retreated from the presence of the British enemy. The British, thinking how great their victory was, and of course the colonists having to retreat, they didn't know that the colonists had waited until all the powder and all the shot was gone, and most of the colonists fought even in the trenches before they retreated. And the commander of the colonist forces was the last man to retreat from the trenches. They stayed and they fought. At the end of the day, they kind of ascertained the totals, and the colonists had lost 100 men at the hands of the British. The British had lost 1,054 trained troops in order to take Bunker Hill. The colonists had retreated and scurried away to replenish their stockpiles of ammunition and to fight again. That brings you up till the point where we'll end this morning, June the 7th, 1776. If I know anything about 1776, you know this is less than a month from the time that our country will break with British rule. June the 7th, 1776, Richard Henry Lee addressed the Continental Congress. The war has been skirmish after skirmish up to this point. Henry Lee makes this petition to the Continental Congress for the first time in the history of the colonies. Resolved that these united colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. That's about as treasonous as you can get. But that is the statement that within a month is going to bring the United States of America into existence through means of the Declaration of Independence. All right, now we've covered a little bit there this morning.